today.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's great to be here at the Marblehead Jewish Community Center for the Marblehead Low Vision Group. This morning, I'm going to talk to you about the Great Hurricane of 1938. It's the last great hurricane to strike Boston. Now, I understand that some of you have vision disabilities. Don't worry about it. I'll drive the narration through my discussion here this morning. I do have images up on the screen. I'm a weather historian, historical astronomer, a New England folklorist. I also research economic events throughout history, American history, great fires, professional sports announcer, and I summered as a boy in Green Harbor, Mass. Today we're going to look at what is a hurricane, take a snapshot view of the GH-38, the Great Hurricane of 1938, a history of North Atlantic hurricanes, we'll briefly look at that, the Great Colonial Hurricane and Great September Gale of 1815, the track of the hurricane, the summer of 38, a muffed forecast, record low air pressure, then as the hurricane struck New York City, Long Island, we'll talk about the flight of the Burghards, some buck-toothed heroes, Connecticut, a movie star's house, the Battle of Colts Dyke, the Great New London Fire, and then Rhode Island. We'll go to the flattening of Rhode Island, wedding splashers, something I call the Mary Poppins of Brant Rock, and then we'll look at the impact on New England. The Great Hurricane in 1938, there were acts of bravery and cowardice. There were acts of kindness and selfishness. It was providence, luck, and cruel fate. Up until that time, the most costly disaster in U.S. history was the Great Hurricane of 1938. It's what I call a lateral buzzsaw. Nobody was prepared because nobody was warned. There were unlikely heroes, and by the time it died out on September 28, 1938, 10 states and 2 countries were affected. I'm not going to get into hurricane ratings, but you hear Category 1 through Category 5. Basically, a Category 1 hurricane has wind speeds with 74 to 95 miles per hour, storm surge of 4 to 5 feet. On the other end of the scale, a Category 5 has winds over 155 miles per hour and storm surges greater than 18 feet. Historically, this is called a Category 3 hurricane. I think it falls between a 3 and a 4 Category 1. It hit landfall. And of course, when you hear about tropical depressions, that's only 23 to 39 miles per hour. Tropical storms, 40 to 73 mile per hour wind gusts. The last major hurricane, and I don't want to say a hurricane, Hurricane Bob came ashore as a tropical depression, maybe a tropical storm in August 1991. And the devastation that it did to the Wareham area was unbelievable. We've seen storm surge. Storm surge is a dome of water 40 to 60 miles long that moves onto the shoreline near landfall at the point of the eye of the hurricane. A cubic yard of seawater weighs approximately 1,700 pounds, and as the waters move inland, more debris floats along with it, causing further damage. Storm surge is responsible for nearly 90% of all hurricane-related deaths and injuries. As an example, in India, 1876, in Bakergunj, 200,000 people died. In Haiphong, China, in 1881, 300,000 people died. That's just storm surge. Wind damage is also a factor of hurricanes. The force of wind can quickly decimate the tree population, down power lines and utility poles, knock over signs, and might be strong enough to destroy some homes and buildings. Flying debris can also cause damage, and in cases where people are caught outdoors, injuries and death. When a hurricane first makes landfall, it's common for tornadoes to form, which can cause severe localized wind damage. In most cases, however, wind is a secondary cause of damage. Storm surge is normally the primary cause. And finally, you get rainfall and flooding. Torrential rains that normally accompany a hurricane can cause serious flooding. Whereas the storm surge and high winds are concentrated near the eye, the rain may extend for hundreds of miles and may last for several days, affecting areas well after the hurricane has diminished. Now, if you look at the United States, and you look at our vulnerable American coastline from Florida, from Miami up to Boston, and even Portland, Maine, with the highest concentrations running from Washington, D.C. up to Boston. You've got Philadelphia, New York City, Boston, and Hartford in the way of hurricanes. In doing a study of hurricanes over the past 100 years, you'll see that they form off the west coast of Africa. They move in a west-northwest pattern, and then they tend to either go straight through the Gulf of Mexico or veer to the north or northeast. So one of the things that's interesting is if you look at the intense New England hurricane strikes of antiquity, through an analysis of sedimentary deposits, they reveal major hurricane strikes along the New England coast took place between the years 1100 and 1150, between the years 1300 and 1400, between the years 1400 and 1450, and then the Great Colonial Hurricane of 1635, the Great September Gale of 1815, and something I call Saxby's Gale in 1869. The Great Colonial Hurricane was the first major hurricane to strike New England. It took place in the old calendar of August 16, 1635. Governor John Winthrop said, quote, "It blew with such violence, with abundance of rain, that it blew down many hundreds of trees, overthrew some houses, and drove ships from their anchors. The tide rose at Narragansett 14 feet higher than ordinary and drowned 8 Indians flying from their wigwams. The ship, the Angel Gabriel, was destroyed, and 21 were lost on board. We believe that the eye passed to the south and east of Boston." William Bradford, in Plymouth at the time, quote, "It caused the sea to swell to the south wind of this place above 20 foot right up and down and made many of the Indians to climb into trees for their safety. It continued above 5 or 6 hours, but the violence began to abate. It blew down many hundreds of thousands of trees. The signs and marks of it will remain this 100 years in these parts." And he was right. And then he says, "The moon suffered a great eclipse the second night after it." And of course, they tried to attribute the hurricane to the eclipse. The Great September Gale of 1815 took place on Saturday, September 23rd, 1815. Noah Webster, great historian, said, quote, "The storm was a proper hurricane. It was one of several severe storms that struck North Atlantic shipping lanes that season. It struck Long Island near Center Mariches. Montauk Lighthouse was heavily damaged. And in the East River in New York, wharves were underwater by 3 feet at 10 in the morning. We believe that the eye passed to the east of Hartford, Connecticut, and Springfield, Mass." The Hampshire Gazette said, quote, "It was a tornado of wind and rain. In Yale, they measured 6.5 inches of rain over two days. The New Haven Register, quote, "It drifted several hogshead of rum and molasses from the wharf." And eastern Connecticut and all of Rhode Island and east central Massachusetts were raked by this hurricane. They said that the rain had a salty flavor, and houses and trees had a white hue from the ocean froth, and it whipped 90-foot sprays from the Charles River. Some accounts have a water spout, which is a tornado on water forming on the Charles River. If you look at the major 20th century hurricanes, of course you have 38. There was the unnamed hurricane in 44, and then you have Hazel in 54. This hurricane was an extratropical cyclone, which means as the eye wall diminishes, the duration is prolonged. So it sped up the coast, and we'll look at that in a moment, and then it just sat over New England as it collapsed, dumping a deluge of rainfall. And as the pressure went down, the duration was prolonged and increasing the damage. If you look at the hurricane itself, it was off the east coast of Cuba on the morning of September 18th. A day later, it slugged forward towards the Bahamas. And then by 2 days later, 8:30 a.m. on September 20th, it was just to the northeast of the Bahamas and due east of Miami. But the following morning, 24 hours later, it was off Cape Hatteras. It was roaring up the coast. And it struck New York City at about 3:30 p.m. on September 21st. The winds increased. It began as a tropical storm off the coast of Africa, went through Category 1, 2, 3, 4. It was actually a Category 5 as it sat off the Bahamas on September 19th with wind gusts of 160-mile-per-hour winds, actually sustained wind gusts. Then it dropped down to a 4 the following day, and as I mentioned, it struck on the 21st when it hit landfall in southern New England with 127-mile-per-hour winds. Again, I think it was a robust 3 just south of a Category 4. If you look at some of the factoids of this hurricane, it was the most costly disaster in U.S. history up to that year. It moved rapidly up the coast at 67 miles per hour, unheard of. It moved 700 miles in 12 hours. The landfall winds at 127 miles per hour, they sustained at 121 miles per hour, and the top wind gust was measured at 156 miles per hour, but at the Blue Hills in Milton, they measured a gust of 186 miles per hour. There were 40-foot storm surges in some places. It hit at high tide. The seas rose 17 feet in some places. And salt water sprayed houses in Montpelier, Vermont, which is 120 miles away from the ocean. Southern New England coastal areas were inundated. Most victims drowned. Some had their clothes blown completely off of them. The first impact of the storm surge registered on seismographs in Alaska. Seawater destroyed vegetation 20 miles inland. Summer of 1938, of course, you could tell me more about that, those who lived through it, but there was record precipitation in June and July. It was a muggy August in a really muggy September. Between September 12th and September 15th, 1938, an inch of rainfall fell each day. Rivers were rising. On September 17th, through the 20th, there was constant rainfall. And on the 20th, the day before the hurricane, the heaviest rainfall. 13 inches of rain fell in 5 days in the Thames River Basin in Connecticut. Some areas reported 17 inches in those 5 days. So what do you have? You have soft soil, weak foundations, and the roots for trees. So the hurricane's impact is exacerbated. What's going on if you picked up the newspaper on Wednesday, September 21st, 1938? Well, the Treaty of Munich is imminent as that noodle Chamberlain waffles and hands Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia over to Hitler through annexation. Of course, Winston Churchill protests. The Boston Red Sox beat the St. Louis Browns 8-4, but remain 11 games back in the American League. The forecast, according to the Lowell Sun, quote, "The weatherman says more rain and cooler tonight and Thursday." A New York Times editorial, dripping with irony, shows up the day the hurricane hits New York, quote, "Every year, an average of three such whirlwinds sweep the tropical North Atlantic between June and November. In 1933, there was an all-time record of 20. If New York and the rest of the world have been so well informed about the cyclone, it's because of an admirably organized meteorological service." And how wrong was he? You got to remember, at that time, in this day and age, in 2010, we can go on the internet, look at the radar, and we can mow our lawns up to 5 minutes before the rain comes because we know it's going to hit up to the minute. Well, in Washington, they had no tools. At the Weather Bureau in Washington, a 28-year-old rookie meteorologist, Charles Pierce, filling in for two vacationing veteran meteorologists, argues that the storm would be sandwiched between two high-pressure systems and it would head directly north through New England. But a longtime veteran meteorologist Charles Mitchell ignores his forecasts. "No hurricane has hit New Jersey during my tenure, and the current storm is weakening." Wrong. There's a barometric nosedive. The RMS Carinthia ship has a reading of 27.85, the lowest in recorded history in the North Atlantic. This is taken off the coast of Virginia early on the morning of September 21st. In Fire Island, within 2 hours, it went from a low reading of 29.78 to an inconceivable low of 27.43 on the 21st of September. My favorite story. On September 21st, a man on West Hampton Beach in New York thought that his new barometer was broken when it measured 28. While he was at the post office sending it back, his house was blown away. The father of typhoons. On the Red Star liner Königstein, the skipper Alfred Leidig has a barometer reading of 28.40 with 100-mile-per-hour winds. On September 19th, Reverend Ernest Gerzi, an Italian Jesuit with 23 years of meteorological experience, while on board the Italian liner Conte di Savoia, bound for New York City, states, quote, "One of my children will be around in about 3 days." This is after he checked his weather charts, barometric readings, and the sky conditions. So it hits New York City. The average gale of 65 miles per hour, a tropical storm. There's 4.5 inches of rain. The city is at a standstill from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Thousands are marooned in office buildings. There's extensive flooding of streets and basements. At 8:45, a power failure at Consolidated Edison left all of the Bronx and parts of Manhattan in darkness. The only death was a hitchhiker who abandoned the stalled car of the kind man who gave him a ride. and as soon as he stepped out of the car, he was carried away by the current. At Fort Schuyler Road in Throgs Neck, they had 9-foot waters by 7:30 p.m. Here's our first hero. J. Gilbert Finning, 40, two of them actually, and William Billy McGrath, age 30. Well, during the evacuation of Fort Schuyler Road, Finning slips and falls while pushing an elderly woman in a boat. McGrath goes after him. They both perish. McGrath is posthumously awarded the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission's Bronze Medal. It's also been dubbed, this hurricane has been called, the Long Island Express. If you look at Long Island, its south coast is exposed to the full fury of whatever comes riding up the Atlantic. There was devastation throughout Long Island. Some wealthy homeowners, and here's that selfishness motif, some wealthy homeowners forced their servants to remain in their mansions and cottages while they evacuated, sealing their fate. One account had a family and friends packed into a car that drove off with their servants watching in ankle-deep rising water on their driveway. Some pets and horses were left behind to fend for themselves and subsequently drowned in the storm surge. After a tree fell on his car, a man on Long Island frantically shook a police officer, saying, "That car's brand new. Who can I sue? Who can I sue?" And of course, there was substantial looting. East Hampton, a devastated village in southern Long Island. West Hampton, Long Island, 28 dead, 4 missing, 153 of 179 houses were destroyed. Trees fell like 10 pins along the highway, blocking the Long Island Expressway. Bridgehampton, New York, sustained heavy damage. Of the estimated 2 billion trees that were lost in the Northeast, 3,500 trees were lost in the Bridgehampton, Sagaponack, Hayground area alone. The elms and locust trees that formed a half-mile-long arch along Main Street had been planted before the American Revolution and can still be seen in the canvases of many important artists of that time. When the storm was over, 42% of the Main Street elms were gone. It hit Nassau, Long Island, crumbling all of the shoreside cottages and houses. In Bayside, New York, Dune Deck, the ocean-torn inlet between West Hampton Beach and Quogue, 400 feet wide and 20 feet deep. Waves broke on lawns 1 mile inland. Fire Island, Long Island, New York, 6 miles south of Bayshore across Great South Bay. Saltaire lost 125 houses. Kismet and Fair Harbor, 91 houses. Oak Beach, 29. And Ocean Beach and Point of Woods suffered severe damage. Over 200 houses that were perched on dunes 20 foot high were raked from the face of the earth on Fire Island. Frederick Foster Durham, he's 54 years of age, a vice president of the Fulton Trust Company. He's on a New York train, marooned in Warwick, Rhode Island. His usual 15-minute trip to New York back to his home took 2 hours on that day. He got home at 8 o'clock. As he washed up for dinner, he dropped dead from exhaustion and exposure. Have you seen my mommy? At Saltaire, the morning after the storm, a young blonde girl sat on a box. As the chief assistant district attorney, Lindsay Henry, arrived, she asked, "Could you assist us in the search for a body?" "Of course," she said. "Whose body is it?" She shut her eyes tightly and sadly said, "My mother's." Some heroes. West Hampton Police Chief Stanley Teller and Officer Timothy Robinson. They saved 17 people. Halfway across the West Bay Bridge, they abandoned their two cruisers and waded and swam the rest of the way. They saved a helpless woman and her 3 children in deep water on Dune Road. They led all 17 onto the roof of the house. A huge wave swept the house off of its foundation. 3 hours later, they landed at Quogue, having crossed the bay, and no lives were lost. Here's a story I'd like to tell you about. It's called The Flight of the Burghards, and I'm going to give you a minute-by-minute, hour-by-hour description. George and Mabel Burghard, their fox terrier dog Bitsy, and their cocker spaniel Peter, with their caretakers Carl and Selma Dalen, rented a cottage. They were 75 feet from the top of a 9-foot dune, 100 feet from Dune Road, and 75 feet from the Coast Guard station. The distance to the water's edge was 200 feet, so they're right up on the ocean. Their neighbors had a 30-foot cabin cruiser moored to the dock between their houses. 10 o'clock in the morning, September 21st. The wind is strong from the north. It's overcast. It begins to drizzle, and the seas are heavy. 11 a.m., the wind shifts to the east, then to the northeast at gale force. Dalen reports water bubbling through concrete floor of the garage. They thought it was going to be fresh water from the bay, but they tasted it. It was salt water. Mabel goes upstairs and puts on her swimsuit. Noontime, the neighbor's boat is drifting. Burghard calls Chief Boatswain's mate James Ketchum at Mauritius Coast Guard Station, which is 3 miles to the west of their location. Ketchum says, "I'll be right down." 1 o'clock, radio station WESF. News bulletin, the West Indies hurricane is in the mid-Atlantic. Wrong, it's right on top of them. Electric power is still on at that point. At 1:30 p.m., the friend of the Burghards, Bill Ottman, he calls and says, "Hey, my garage just got blown away. It's into the bay." 2 o'clock, 90-mile-per-hour winds are shifting to the east. The water's now 2 feet deep in the Burghards' garage. Mabel is sewing in the sunroom with her back to the bay windows. Mrs. Dalen suggests that she change her seat. Just as Mabel does that, the wind blows out with glass shards shot everywhere. 2:30 p.m., wind and rain intensifying. The Burghards' bathhouse is swept away. 3 o'clock, Burghard tells Dalen time to pack up clothes and move to the third floor. 10 minutes later, 3:10, a wave breaks through the back door and sweeps Dalen off of his feet. 3:30 p.m., John Avery of the Coast Guard comes across the meadow. "Let's get moving, people, quickly. No time to lose." High tide was due at 6:10 p.m. Burghard stuffs his tennis tickets for the match at Forest Hills the following day into his pocket. 4 o'clock, Mabel Burghard picks up Peter and George picks up Bitsy, their dogs. The Dalens, who are much older, are dilly-dallying. The wind is now up over 100 miles per hour. They have a half-mile walk to the bridge across the bay. Mrs. Dalen is being nearly dragged by Avery. Old Carl Dalen clings to the fence post back down on the driveway as the group moves down the road. Can you imagine leaving your husband behind? Old Carl then sits down on the fence. He's exhausted. Imagine walking into headlong 100-mile-per-hour winds. That'll take the wind out of you quickly. Got to be a strong person. He's exhausted. He has his head down, and now he's 75 feet behind the group that's moving towards the bridge. He can't hear their call due to the wind. Mrs. Dalen is now hysterical for her husband. The wind suddenly shifts to the southeast at 110 miles per hour, and there are 50-foot breakers that roar over the dunes. Flotsam drifts by in the raging sea torrents, and there's a boat tied to the dock, and they immediately move toward it. 4:15 p.m., with a sickening crash, the Coast Guard station hits the bay and smashes to pieces. Just then, the line snaps, and the boat, their only salvation, is dragged out to sea. Electric wires hit the ocean and puddles, and electrocution is a distinct possibility. Mrs. Dalen is now 50 feet behind the group, refusing to move, calling to her husband Carl, who is now 125 feet beyond the group. The Burghards, with their dogs under their arms, go out onto a broken dock and lie down, hoping to ride it like a surfboard. Just then, a large flat piece of wooden siding comes by, and Mabel, George, the dogs, and Coast Guardsman Avery climb onto it. The wind had driven the bay water across to the mainland with such force that for about 200 feet, the bay bottom was completely dry. Meanwhile, the Dalens are helpless. The Burghards and Avery jump off the board and wait for a giant wave that takes them 200 feet out into the bay. 6-foot waves continually wash them off the board and they climb right back on. They dodge flotsam, cars, jagged glass and boards with nails moving quickly by them. Dogs are placed on a trailer raft, a little raft that goes behind them. Well, Bitsy the dog is washed off and the other dog, Peter, grabs him by the ear and drags him back to the raft. They paddle around huge chunks of houses and debris. Ducks fly by backwards at 40 miles per hour. The raft is then grounded in berry bushes. Bitsy disappears somewhere in the brush. They end up landing 1 mile west from their house at Onek, across the bay, and they head to higher ground at the golf course. They wave down a car and make their way into West Hampton. Avery, his job done, moves off to help more people. Some of their personal belongings are found miles away from their house. When the Daylens' bodies are located, Carl is found ironically near the golf course where they were positioned with a broken leg. John Avery is cited for bravery, and they find wood pierced through wood like an arrow. Every street corner has an armed man looking for looters. There's 48-hour price gouging. There's that selfishness again. And that awful sea smell stuck around for over a year. Quogue, New York, the gymnasium used as a mortuary. There was a breach at Shinnecock Inlet where the ocean actually went over the isthmus and caused a channel. It was open, and one month later it changed the currents in the harbor. The heroes of Stony Point, unlikely heroes. Up on the board, if you can't see it, two beavers. 60 colonies of beavers moved from the Adirondacks. 500 beavers built 60 dams. The dams in Palisades Park were held back swollen rivers and ponds. These beavers, knowing the major storm was imminent, worked all through the night to fortify their bulwarks before the hurricane struck. Long Mountain Beaver Pond doubled in size from 5 to 10 acres due to the dam made of mud, sticks, stones, and sod. It was 150 yards long and 6 feet high, and it held fast, only spilling 18 inches of water over its top. Cedar Hill Pond Dam doubled in size to 8 acres. It was 40 feet wide and water rose 2 feet. What they did, though, these beavers, is they saved 5 arterial highways that were used for evacuation. They saved Long Mountain Road, Johnstown Road, U.S. Highway 617, and Route 9 West. The heroes of Stony Point. Now, next up, the southeast coast of Connecticut. It slammed from Saybrook Point to Stonington. There's a major train story that I want to tell you about. I'm going to just give you some brief details. A train called the Bostonian had 275 passengers, and it was returning many students to prep schools. Well, at 3:30 p.m., the railroads were ordered to halt, and the train fireman checks the tracks as water is rising rapidly. He wants to evacuate. Suddenly, a 30-foot sailboat smashes into the train. 160 people crammed into the engine in the front car. And I got to tell you that the conductor, a man by the name of Brown, there were students who were unruly. He smashed the fire axe and he held it over his head. Now are you going to move to the front car? And the students obliged. There are other people who had just served their dinner and refused to move to the front car. And that old axe there, holding it over his head, got him to move up front. Well, the engineer got the engine moving on the fourth try, and he plowed debris and dragging wires out of the way. One of his men dove into the water and managed to uncouple the derailed cars. What happened is they saved many lives, and when they finally rolled into Stonington Station, with great relief, they had saved 275 people. In Danielson, Connecticut, a famous photograph of a 120-year-old steeple that was toppled by the brutal winds of Great Hurricane of 1938. Katherine Hepburn, Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Let's look at her. Well, she's considered in 1938 to be box office poison, and she had just auditioned for a film that was about to commence production. With her boyfriend Red Hammond, she went and played golf. She remembered it was very humid and breezy that day. Well, on the par 3 ninth hole, she scored a hole in one. She finished with her best round ever, an incredible 31 on 9 holes. Afterwards, she and Red went for a swim in front of their house. She stated about the breezy weather and the rising surf, quote, "Something very special is going to happen." Their family had an elegant summer home in Old Saybrook, and it had been there since the turn of the century. Her brother Dick was in the house working on a Hollywood script at the time. Kate was waiting to hear if she got the part of Scarlett O'Hara in, ironically, Gone with the Wind. She had just finished making Bringing Up Baby earlier in the year, which was a flop. The water rose 17 feet high, and Dick and Catherine got the family out as two chimneys crumbled and the guest cottage drifted a half mile away. Family heirlooms were lost in the mud. Dick would find his typewriter and his scripts perfectly intact. Days later, when Kate got home, she was on her knees, some say inebriated, digging in vain for her family's jewelry, as Red tugged her gently on her shoulders and whispered, "Honey, it's time to leave." The Battle of Colt's Dyke, Connecticut River, Hartford, 1,200 WPA workers, World War I vets, college students and volunteers fight to keep 1 million tons out of the south end of the city that was devastated in 1936. There was a great flood along the Connecticut River in 1936, and so that was still fresh in their minds. The Army engineers say there's a 50-50 chance that their bulwark will hold when the water crests at a remarkable 28 feet. There's a plan to dynamite Clark's Dyke should it not hold to save the industrial area. So do you save the homes or do you save the industrial area? And obviously they're going to say, we'll save the industrial area. At the Connecticut River in Hartford, in this photo, an arrow points to the Traveler's Insurance Tower. The clock in the old State House stopped at 4:10 p.m. Mrs. Carl Carlson, driving towards Guilford, Connecticut, was stopped in traffic as they removed a tree from the road. She picked up a book to read. Just then, a tree came crashing down on her car, killing her instantly. She was reading Gone with the Wind. Connecticut River rose 4 inches per hour. Matt Strong caught a 5-pound bass with his hands on Main Street. Fred Fredsall's apple trees were blown over and then later blown upright and yielded fruit for a few years afterwards. There was storm surge in New London with 110-mile winds and a great fire. In Cheshire, Patrick Joyce was killed when he was hurled against a brick wall of a prison building. And then, from Connecticut, it moved towards Rhode Island. Again, all these people were unprepared. The plight of the Moore family. They were washed out at Watch Hill. 11 people, including 3 servants, crammed into the attic of a sturdy house on the edge of Little Narragansett Bay. Mr. Moore had suffered a heart attack that morning, but he managed to board up the house. The roof was ripped off and thrown into the sea, so the entire family jumps into an ad hoc raft. Huge waves crashed upon them, and hammerhead sharks followed the raft. They floated clear across the peninsula, and by the way, before I go on, those hammerheads probably were taken with the current and the hurricane brought up with the south, really had no choice. They floated clear across the peninsula, the bay, and then drifted onto a cove on Barn Island. They huddled in an abandoned barn and watched the glow of the great New London fire. They were rescued by lobstermen on September 22nd. All 39 houses on Watch Hill were wiped off the face of the earth. It was turned into a sand dune. A 20-mile stretch from Napatree Point to Point Judith, 175 casualties, dead. Napatree Point, before and after. You can see the dance halls and the houses and the cottages and the mansions right up on the waterfront. After the hurricane in 1938, it's hard to believe that anything stood there. It was just a sand dune. The storm hit westerly Rhode Island at 3:50 p.m. and killed 100 people. 194 of 200 homes were destroyed. 50 bodies were found washed up on the sand dunes at Mesquamacat Beach. Mesquamacat Beach suffered severe damage along the Rhode Island coast. In Island Park, Rhode Island, 19 were dead, 198 of 200 houses destroyed. The tidal marsh brought in a storm surge at Newport, Rhode Island. In Conemaugh Beach in Narragansett Bay, another 100 houses were destroyed. At Oakland Beach, 100 left homeless. Woman is heard to say, "My baby has just been blown out of my arms." Jamestown, Rhode Island, 14 people perished in the Barrington area. At Jamestown, Rhode Island, the Governor Carr Ferry, 86 of 100 boats, including the Governor Carr Ferry, were destroyed on Block Island. What did people say? The 3 most common quotes heard after the hurricane of 1938 in Rhode Island were, "Where do I go now? Everything that I own is gone." And of course, the heartbreaking, "I had no insurance." The rats at Brown University, and this is not a reference to the people who work in the bursar's office. The calls began coming into a couple of local exterminators that mice had infested a woman's dormitory on September 21st, the morning, and that rats were seen at the library. Could they possibly have been seeking higher ground at College Hill? Also, many cats and dogs went missing on the morning of the hurricane. Squirrels and birds were reportedly moving about in an agitated manner, according to residents of Plymouth. In Providence, the city is a perfect funnel and aqueduct. The storm surge struck at 5:15, just as power went out and people were leaving their offices. A white wall of water rushed up Providence River. A deluge of water 13 feet high crested in city streets. Providence City Hall and Biltmore Hotel suffered substantial flooding on their ground floors. The Providence River rose 17 feet in 70 minutes. Appliances and consumer goods floated down the streets from department stores. And keep in mind, we're just coming out of the Great Depression right here. I mean, there's daylight at the end of the tunnel. We're in the waning years of the Great Depression. People didn't have money. People were very, very poor. A canoe washed up at Exchange Place in downtown Providence and sat there for over a week. The Monhegan, a steamer, was sunken and wedged into a pier near downtown Providence. Couldn't get it out. I call this wedding splashers. Joe Fogle and Lorraine Martin were scheduled to get married on the second floor in the ballroom of the Narragansett Hotel in downtown Providence. Their marriage, their upcoming marriage, was featured in the social scene of the local newspapers. Back then, they'd write about who's getting married, and almost like the inside track is with the Boston Herald today with that gossip. It was more social, what's happening. But where's Joe? What's he got, cold feet? Ready to have a wedding here. No, he's stuck at Union Station with his family. So 500 refugees from the storm sought shelter in the hotel, Narragansett Hotel. Well, what'd they do? They feasted on the wedding banquet and drank all the champagne. Joe shows up at 11 o'clock, and they have a nice candlelight ceremony presided over by a very anxious minister. They had a short walk on a smelly, muddy street, the water receded by about 10 o'clock, to their honeymoon suite at the Biltmore Hotel. The Mary Poppins of Brant Rock. A 10-year-old boy in Brant Rock, Massachusetts, saw that the weather was getting wild late on the afternoon of September 21st, 1938. He decided to heighten the exhilaration of the storm by getting his grandfather's best umbrella out of the closet and climbing up onto the garage roof. He jumped off the roof, thinking that he might even fly. As he tumbled to the ground, the umbrella was bent and broken. He received what's known as red bottom for his poor judgment. That boy was my father. Massachusetts South Coast. An eyewitness to the storm surge that hit Horse Neck Beach to Buzzards Bay at 5 p.m. This is eyewitness to storm surge. Incredible. He says, quote, "A long black band is approaching. A solid black wall of water looks like an unusually large black roller coming into the shore, with its top being blown off so that it did not curl up and break like an ordinary wave." It's almost like a tidal wave. There are 30-foot breakers at Horse Neck Beach. 41 people perish in Fall River. Ships, boats, and barges are torn off of their moorings and docks. The oil tanker Phoenix spills its cargo and is blown across the river onto lawns. In New Bedford, 9 cotton mills are destroyed, 10,000 employees are left jobless, and the New Bedford economy would never recover from the storm. The Acushnet River rose 11 feet, and 1,500 people were left homeless in Fairhaven. I would have guessed there weren't even 1,500 homes in Fairhaven. Now, the fishing fleets are overdue. According to the New Bedford Standard Times, quote, "Women stood with babies in their arms and watched the horizon in the ageless manner of wives whose men ply the sea. Others went from boat to boat asking questions. Everywhere, the answer was a simple negative shake of the head." Westport Harbor, New Bedford, Woods Hole, Wareham, Bourne Bridge, very famous picture. National Guardsmen standing atop the roof of a house in the Cape Cod Canal under the newly opened Bourne Bridge. Bourne Bridge had only been open for about 5 years at that time. Martha's Vineyard saw 25-foot waves at Chilmark. Menemsha destroyed. The bridge from Gayhead to Menemsha was wiped out. So many communities, not only coastal communities, but communities well inland. Remember, this eye of the storm, it travels up the Connecticut River Valley. That's why Hartford saw such damage. East Brookfield, Springfield, Mass., East Bridgewater, Mattapoisett, Taunton, all saw extensive damage. Newton, Fairhaven, Wareham, West Brookfield, Boston all saw extensive damage. Ware, Worcester, North Uxbridge, and even Putnam, Connecticut were devastated. Downtown Boston, trees fell on Arlington Street. Massachusetts State House had a tree fall right across the street. The hatch shell at the Esplanade, Charles River, Boston, was flooded. Even on Lexington Green, the historic green where the Battle of the Revolution took place, trees fell and rendered the battlefield useless. Trees fell on Exeter, New Hampshire, Peterborough, New Hampshire. According to the Boston Post, 45 were killed in wild hurricane property damage and millions were hurt by the wreckage. Then the Boston Globe says no, the hurricane dead is 250. Then the Daily News says no, it's 322 dead. Now the deaths, according to the Daily Record, are 390. Finally, the Boston Herald says storm deaths mount to 515, 100,000 homeless, whole towns wiped out. Some facts of the hurricane. The peak steady winds were 121 miles per hour. Peak gust, as I mentioned, 186 miles per hour at Great Blue Hill. The lowest pressure, although this is debatable, on shore was 27.94 at Belport, New York. Peak storm surge, 17 feet above the normal high tide at Rhode Island. 50-foot peak wave heights right down the street at Gloucester. 700 deaths, 600 in New England. 63,000 homeless. 20,000 miles of power wire knocked down, 8,900 homes and buildings destroyed, 3,300 boats were lost, 26,000 automobiles destroyed, 2 billion trees destroyed, 2 billion trees destroyed. The cost in 1938 dollars was $6.2 million, and that's $15 billion in 1998, and you can probably double that and call it close to $30 billion in current dollars. Shirley Ann Gatz was born at 3:28 p.m. at Eastern Long Island Hospital just as the roof was blown off and flooded the delivery room. Normally when I give this lecture, I ask who was born on September 21st, 1938, and I had a man said I was premature. My mom was rushed to the hospital and gave birth to me because of the pressure. As I mentioned, some other great hurricanes to hit New England. 1944, it was called the Great Atlantic Hurricane. This is before they named them. And it generally cut through the same swath as the Great Hurricane in 1938. Edna in 54 went right through the Cape Cod Canal. Carol in 54 went right up, almost followed the identical track as Hurricane 38, right up the Connecticut River Valley. Diane in 55 swung into North Carolina and then cut back out to the sea and scoured the southern New England coast. Donna in 1960 again followed the relatively the same track as the Great Hurricane of 1938 before dying out in Newfoundland. So if you look at the great hurricanes, and we're not talking about Katrina. We're talking about 38. Katrina is the all-time most devastating hurricane in terms of damage. But 38, $306 million of 1938 dollars. So what do you do when a hurricane comes? Scientific studies have shown that a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread are not your best protection against a major storm. Check the tides and stay away from the beach. When officials tell you to leave your house, you leave. Don't panic in a traffic jam. Shut off your engine to conserve fuel. Know where the high ground is in your own town and neighborhood. The winds will shift, so don't count on the wind blowing constantly in one direction. If possible, the most important thing you can possibly do is carry clean drinking water. Live without food for a few days, but it's the water that gets you first. Stay away from down power lines and, if possible, any water containing down lines. And be aware that trees and houses can topple in an instant. Don't swim against the current. If you're within 2 miles of the coast, you're vulnerable to storm surge. And like I like to say, if you're a clown, you will drown. So, we're overdue for a hurricane. And the National Hurricane Center, unfortunately, has been drastically incorrect in their hurricane predictions, especially over the past 5 years. missing by 7-8 storms. And at some point, a hurricane has to come north and strike New England, southern New England. Most likely, and I think it'll take the same path as 38, come right across Long Island, rip up through Connecticut, Rhode Island, and then into Boston. I don't see it forming like a nor'easter where we have storms that back into Boston. But if we do, you have storm surge vulnerability with the Mystic River, Neponset River, Charles River, flooding. It gets all that water that's pushed in by the storm, if it's pushed in especially from east to west, will flood out on its plains. My resources today: Everett Allen's A Wind to Shake the Earth, Cherie Burns' Great Hurricane 1938, R.A. Scotty's Sudden Sea, and Aram Gutsuzian's The Hurricane of 1938. That's my talk, and you've been a great audience. Thank you.
Great.
Does anybody have a story they'd like to tell? I've already heard from Walter. They recall from the hurricane in 1938.
Might sound very mild after all that.
Yeah. All right, sir, could you tell me about your experience with the 1938 hurricane? Your name is?
Walter Kester.
And Walter, where'd you grow up?
Pine Street in Swampscott. And we're at Abbott Park playing football, and the trees started to blow and the leaves started to fly. So first we climbed the trees to ride the wind, and we got tired of that. Someone said, let's go to the beach. Well, we went down to King's Beach, which was right by Doan's restaurant, which is just in front of the old Hawthorne, and there were some sailboats dragging in, and it was low tide. So we waded out to the sailboats with a few pushes of the legs and a few strokes of the arms. We sat on the sailboats, let the waves rock us up and down. So we got tired of that, because the police department was at the beach and they were hollering at us to come in. So we finally came in and they sent us home. Well, we no more got home, and the evening came on and someone said there was water down at the end of Pine Street. Well, what happened is the tide had come in and where C&L liquor store is today used to be a gas station, and there was 4 to 5 feet of water at that gas station. Now, the land between the ocean and the gas station back to Erie Street to Kiley Park is almost one grade. So the flood came in across, which is Kings Beach Terrace area, came across into the C&L liquor store area, over and back to Erie Street. From Erie Street, it went down and flooded Kiley Park, and then it headed down Route 1A towards Abbott Park. So we had one big lake, and we all at the being boys, we all got the same idea at once: get out your kayaks. So we got the kayaks out and we paddled from Swampscott to Lynn to Abbott Park. And the police department again was after us, because I guess they were afraid we were going to get electrocuted. And after a while we got tired of that, because we came too close to Pine Street and our parents were out after us.
Can't imagine why.
And it ruined the whole party. We finally landed our kayaks and went home. And that was the end of our fun. And we woke up the next day, the sun was shining. Huh? And they actually made us go to school that day. That was the end of my party.
Do you remember any damage?
Oh, yeah, the damage was, trees were down everywhere. Pine Street, especially like my street, Pine Street, it looked like originally it looked like a tunnel. You could look up the street, and all you saw was the branches on both sides from the trees on both sides of the street overhanging, forming a canopy like. So when I went out on the street the next morning, there was no canopy. Most of the heavy trees were down. And it was the same way around town. A lot of the old good-looking heavy trees were down, and they didn't have the chainsaws like they have today. The men are out there with the big saws, two men to a saw, cutting the trees up. But other than that,
did you hear of any injuries?
Your day was ruined, huh?
Injuries, I don't remember. I wasn't thinking about injuries. I was too young to.
I remember the roof was off our house.
Didn't think of it. Oh, yeah, there were a lot of houses with damaged roofs.
My father went out looking for two of my brothers, and after about an hour, my mother went out looking for them. Wow. And she left my sister, who was 18 months older than myself and me, with 9 kids to take care of. And then the roof went off the house, and we took the kids downstairs a couple of floors because we were on the 4th floor, and we went down to the 2nd floor, and we just sat on the floor in the hallway until it was all over.
And if you look at the houses on Route 1A going to Abbott Park from C&L Liquor Store, you see the foundations of brickwork at least 3 feet high. Because that whole area originally in the 1700s, coming into the 1800s, was a swamp area. In Route 1A was the old Indian path, you know. So that's why the houses were built high originally, so they wouldn't flood.